So Eldon is here to present his next section, which perhaps he'll have time to finish.
No, he never finished anything yet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, we hadn't been able to finish either of the other sessions to get the material all covered. So
that's a subject you'll never end up finishing.
Yeah, so that's in order to make sure that he lives a long life. As long as you have unfinished business, you have to stick around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Eldon, go ahead and
don't forget to introduce your mic to there.
Okay. I guess are we all kind of collected here? Are those of you who are way up there, do you find me audible at all?
I mean,
does it make any difference?
Just the right level, you can sleep good, right?
I mean, I don't want to interrupt your slumbers, but on the other hand, I'd like to, this is the third, Eldon Olson, third session. And what was it called? Sexuality of the Pastors. Pastor is a sexual person, and I'm going to kind of combine some of the things that we didn't about counseling and about pastoral care of self as a sexual person, and because they are very much combined. Our awareness of ourselves as sexual persons sometimes causes difficulties, particularly in certain kinds of counseling relationships. Let me begin with a very clear and earnest plea. By far the most painful and personally wrenching experiences I have had in the 3 years and 2 months that I've occupied the office of Director of Consultation of Clergy have come in situations where pastors have been exposed as having been involved in an inappropriate sexual behavior with a parishioner. Those situations are absolute nightmares. They are the most painful situations because of the incredible ramifications they have. I'm not talking about, but let me put it this way, I'm talking about a pastor whose own personal problems regarding human sexuality, regarding himself, leads him to be involved in compulsive or inappropriate behaviors that somehow or other with someone who perceives him to be the pastor. And it leads me always to the conclusion that pastors do not have affairs. Pastors have sexual abuse. The nature of the office changes the language. And the nature of the office means that we have to be incredibly conscious, not only of our dynamics as human beings, as sexual human beings, but of the dynamics of persons with whom we are called to pastorally relate. And my plea is, if you find yourself involved in situations which are compulsive or which are relationally of great shame to you, may I plead with you to get help. For your own sake, because help is available, for the sake of your church, because it is a wrenching experience for a congregation, for the sake of your spouse, for the sake of your family. And that's all I'm going to say on that rather gloomy note. But I want to start there, because the 7 or 8 situations that have arisen in the tenure of my office in the last 8 years, or in the last 3 years, have just made me just a grave concern for us as persons and for the well-being of our church and our families.
While you're on that, is there any literature available for a pastor who would follow a pastor?
That's a really good question. I think one of the great mistakes of previous practices in the church is that when a pastor did have an indiscretion or a tremendous problem that produced a scandal of some sort, that somehow or other, naively, sometimes people simply were moved on quietly or moved out quietly. And never everyone thought that nobody knew. And the pastor who comes 10, 15 years later finds himself in a tremendous situation of stress and turmoil within congregations. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but it is my conviction that you need to offer treatment to a congregation in which sexual abuse has taken place from the pastoral office, just as certainly as you need to offer treatment to a family in which there has been incest. Because the parallel between pastoral sexual abuse and its functional effect on a congregation and an abusive father and its functional effect on a family is very strong. The dynamics are much the same. In consultation to clergy, we can document congregations where 20-some years ago a scandal has occurred, it was hushed up and slipped out of town, and since then consultation of clergy have had to treat successive pastors, three, four, in one case four of them, for precisely the same burnout symptoms. That the pathology of the congregation becomes worked out in continues on and on and on. Because what's fundamentally destroyed is the trusting relationship between the parish and the pastor. And you have constant situations of stress.
Is there anything written on that, though?
Yeah, Pete Steinke has done some work on it. I've done some work on it. Got a little essay anyway. Alban has some work on it. It's an area in which there's some stuff now being written, and it's something that I think I'm beginning. Certainly, Edmund Friedman's Generation to Generation begins to talk about the systemic nature of these kind of violations. But it's something we're beginning to be aware of. It's something I've been aware of in consultation to clergy, just as I meet pastors, three or four pastors, who describe how they had to leave such and such a parish, burned out, depressed, just incredibly demoralized. And sure enough, you meet four of them and you realize they all had the same symptomatology when they left, and the congregation goes chugging along, burning out the fifth one. And it's easy to blame the congregation, but I don't blame the congregation. You have to begin to uncover the pain and allow that pain to be worked through in the anguish of some kind of methodical treatment of that woundedness.
I was just going to say, I like what you said, you can't blame the congregation.
No.
You can't blame anyone.
Mm-mm.
Because blaming doesn't solve the problem.
No.
You have to just work through it, take it where you are and work through it.
My experience of those congregations, even 10, 15 years later, it's like coming on to the scene of a dreadful accident. And there will be great numbers of deeply wounded human beings. They won't show it necessarily until you really get to what it is that was doing the bruising.
Elvin?
Yes.
I wonder if that sort of situation isn't more widespread than we imagine. I don't think just in terms of the particular issue that we are involved in, but in a number of ways where there have been significant pastor-congregational conflict, or whether it's led to a pastor being forced to resign or take a call, or whether it's led to a suicide or something like that, where that hasn't been, where that treatment of the congregation hasn't taken place, and ministers who followed have suffered.
Yes.
Because I think it to our own circuit, and I think also of other pastors and other circuits who I've known, where they followed some sort of significant problem in a parish, and then experienced those problems themselves. And I guess my feeling is that that may be very common.
Yes, it is. I guess that's a whole nother week. Another year or two, let me come back and we'll spend some time on that. For now, I want to talk about that you're right, it is a very common phenomenon, and it appears in many different forms, and I think we're just beginning to get some literature and to get some understanding of that. Another expression, certainly the pastor was the sexual indiscretion. Certainly the pastor, predecessor pastor who was into an addictive behavior, including work addiction, his successor has one heck of a time. Certainly a predecessor pastor who would not allow people to minister to him. My example of that is a man, pastor, who had cancer and literally died in front of people Sunday after Sunday after Sunday without ever admitting to anybody that he was ill. The congregation has been in a perpetual state of grief for 22 years. Totally unresolved. And so it comes in many different forms. Yes?
Based on those several cases you mentioned of indiscretion by the pastors, is there any kind of a pattern that you see that maybe we need to be aware of?
I'll spend some time with that. Sure. In the congregation or in the pastor?
Yeah, in the pastor.
Let me move into that. Let me talk about pastoral care, pastoral counseling, and pastor's own sense of his own sexuality in intimate, close relationships like counseling. Regarding counseling of persons who have been victims of sexual violence, sexual abuse, persons in your parishes, and I assure you there are many, my summary word for that in counseling postures to them is don't. Sexuality issues and sexual abuse survivors is a highly specialized field of counseling. I don't know anybody in this room, myself included, who has the training to do it. As counselors, as pastors, yes. As pastors, we have the office of word and sacrament, and that's why yesterday, when we talked about pastoral care to victims of sexual abuse, I talked about worship, parish education, preaching, teaching, and evangelism. As much as possible, refer, but do not defer. In other words, keep up with the person. Continue to show pastoral, gentle, loving concern. Continue to remember the person in your prayers. Put them right at the top of your daily list. Let them know you are praying for them. Be involved in ministries of the gentleness of Jesus. Any occasion which arises, let them know of your concerns and of your compassion. But in general, do not do counseling that expects therapeutic healing. Because I think we're ill-equipped. And it is a highly specialized field, and it's a field, I think, which in which there are some tremendous how do you say it? We have some tremendous vulnerabilities. So no, make referrals, and secondly, know the resources. Know what's going on in our communities. The state of Washington is developing, has developed over the last 10 years, superb systems. Know where Children's Protective Service can be reached. Know how to get a hold of them and use them. Know where a woman's shelter is. Know how to contact it. They're not easy to contact, by the way. They are deliberately and intentionally not easy to contact. But pastors should know where they are. Know where programs and groups are meeting for victims of spousal abuse, of violence. Know where those programs exist. If possible, participate in those programs occasionally. Some of them will welcome a pastor just as a typical AA group will welcome a pastor on open occasions. Know not only where the treatment programs are for women, but know where there are treatment programs for men who may be the abusers. I know there are programs in Spokane, in the Tri-Cities, and Wenatchee. There are excellent counseling facilities in Spokane, the Tri-Cities, and Wenatchee. There's a couple here in Wenatchee, just down the road here, Bob and Adrian Brzee, who are tops. There's a Presbyterian minister, Brzee's, he's a Methodist minister. There's a Presbyterian pastor in Spokane, gone. Anyone know who I'm talking about?
Howard Haig.
Yep, Howard Haig, who's tops. Know who these people are. Know where you can get compassionate help. Know where referrals can be made for a variety of human issues that somehow or other you might encounter. Know the resources of the law. Know the processes of the courts. Know your legal responsibility regarding the processes of the courts. Do not hide behind pastoral confidentiality. Pastoral confidentiality exists where a person confesses to you a sin he has committed but will not commit again because he repents. It does not apply to a sin you know darn good and well he's going to do again. Okay? It does not apply to sins of compulsive behaviors. Pastoral confidentiality assumes that the sin is repentantly over. And I would commend you to silence. It does not cover situations in which there are compulsive or obsessive behaviors where you know as well as anybody that the sin will continue. Know the resources of the law. Know what is taking place in the law regarding family violence, abuse, sexual abuse, etc.
I think we have to instruct our congregations before we go to the pastor. Because when the congregation finds out, the pastor's taking consults someone for help, then it's over 200-300 people.
It's a very, very difficult situation. I would suggest that one of the most difficult situations, again, about the pastoral person who is himself sexually abusive has been the realization that in typical congregations there were people, many people, who knew. And I'm not suggesting that we all become somehow or other tattletales and blow the whistle. I'm suggesting that we try as much as possible to create, my word, arenas in which we can honestly seek to get help for somebody. who is involved in compulsive behavior. And that's really complex. If you are involved in any kind of counseling relationship with persons who have histories of having been sexually abused or victims of violence, may I suggest that some of you, particularly in rural areas, I served my first years of ministry in a rural area of northern Wisconsin, and since served rural areas, pastoral interims in Montana, and I know that that is a tremendously challenging ministry. And sometimes it is very, very difficult to find the referral sources that you will need. So let me make a third point. Resources, referrals, and thirdly, and that is find somebody with whom and you have a supervisory relationship. I'm not talking about like an internship or vicarage where you had a supervisor who wrote a report on you and evaluated you as a human being. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about supervision in pastoral counseling situations. Anybody who's in the pastoral and counseling business who does not have a regular supervisory relationship with a counseling mental health professional is in a very, very, I think, very vulnerable spot. And my rule goes what I call the 5-5-10 rule. No more than 5 hours of counseling with any person without supervision. No more than 5 hours per week of counseling without supervision. And 1 hour of supervision for every 10 hours of counseling. Now, the function of supervision, and this has to do with the whole pastoral sexuality issue, the function of supervision is not just so that somebody else is monitoring your counseling processes and procedures with a given parishioner or person. The function of supervision is mutuality, pardon me, is the sense that you yourself are dealing with issues that arise within you during the counseling process. Okay? Because counseling persons who are deeply troubled involves us invariably in levels and layers of our own selves where we might find some muddy water. And some of our muddy water might become projected into the processes we are involved in. That's not all bad, by the way. It's the reason why ex-alcoholics are the best counselors of alcoholics. Those of us who have had certain kinds of stresses and certain kinds of painful experiences of our lives are very helpful to others who are going through the same experiences. If your congregation has a group of persons who have been deeply wounded with the loss of a loved one, they are extremely helpful to others who are grieving. We become strong through our woundedness. Very biblical. So I'm not suggesting that we have to be persons that are 100% together, but I am suggesting that there should be in any counseling relationship, especially in counseling relationships where potentialities of intimacy issues are involved, there should be somebody with whom we monitor not only what is happening to the person with whom we are counseling, but what is happening to ourselves in the counseling process. That's what supervision is. It should be, ideally, it should be somebody who is a mental health professional. And usually, it's been my experience that as pastors, experiences of supervision with mental health professionals, good ones, usually end up being mutuality sessions. because we bring much to their profession in terms of faith, life, insights, and processes. They bring much to our sessions in terms of the understanding of human dynamics. Perhaps even several supervisory persons representing different kinds of mental health, emotional well-being, family life, processes of growth, etc. issues. But at any rate, some kind of person with whom and to whom you regularly share what is taking place, not only with the counselee, but also with yourself as a person involved in the counseling process.
Is this monitoring process common for all mental health professionals?
It is mandated. The only professional that gets away with doing counseling without it is clergy that I know of. AAPC, AAMFT, all of them have some kind of a built-in mandated process of supervisory counseling relationships. I really commend it to you. It is costly. I commend it to you. If you're going to do counseling, I commend it to your parishes as a part of their budget. It'll run you somewhere between $50 and $100 an hour. It's the only way I know of to maintain a continuous growing expertise in terms of our abilities as counselors. Otherwise, I'd say don't do it. Don't counsel.
How about using the pulpit?
Well, certainly. Yeah, for counseling, for pastoral care. Yeah, absolutely. You know, certainly need that psychiatric expertise. I'm talking specifically about the pastoral counseling session. Yeah.
What if the mental health professional who supervises you has a fundamentally different anthropology than you do, and there you are at loggerheads?
Well, again, it depends on how different, and it depends on, certainly don't work with somebody who's just coming out of completely different posture. It's been my experience that many, don't make the assumption that mental health professionals have no faith posture. Most people in healing professions, it's been my experience, most people in healing professions have profound faith postures. And you may find some who don't and find another. As a matter of fact, I do some shopping around. If it is totally impossible for you to do some kind of supervisory work with a mental health professional, then the very least you should be doing is some kind of supervisory exchange in what was called yesterday the whole practice of a colloquium or a collegium or a, what was the, casuistic group. Some kind of a group of peers with whom and to whom you can openly and honestly relate. But again, don't just get there and swap information about how to help the person. It should be a very determined and concerted effort to get to know what is taking place within you and have that monitored. In general, I think there are several areas, particularly, where we ought not be involved without supervisory processes. They are highly technical areas of counseling, such as chemical abuse and alcoholism, counseling with adult survivors of sexual abuse, any counseling that uses highly intense intimate sensitivity encounter groups, any kind of counseling that involves touching or intimate contact with persons. You know, a pastor who is involved in massage therapy. And or counseling with persons whom you personally find offensive. Don't do it. let me just, I just kind of talked about supervision. And again, it has to do with the way in which we not only do counseling, i.e. taking care of people pastorally, it has to do with the way in which we monitor our own sexuality. We have some kind of a way of testing out with other human beings. Therefore, you know your limits, especially the limitations of your skills and of your energies. And be honest with people about your limitations. State very clearly to people, I am your pastor, not your therapist. I am not going to fix you or cure you any more than you would try to prescribe medication to somebody who had influenza. I will care for you. I will pray for you. I will earnestly lift you up. I will minister to you with word and with sacrament. I will be to you someone who announces the forgiveness of sins and the compassionate grace of God. But I am not your therapist. Be real clear about who you are and what you can do and what you can't do. My experience with pastors who were sexually abusive, whose inappropriate behaviors became compulsive, and exposed, is all of them were persons who came across as incredibly warm, touchy-feely, loving, helping. And that, I have some real value for all of those virtues. But there's those virtues do not heal others. In fact, they may be causing enormous woundedness for the pastor himself. Okay?
Elden?
Yeah.
I think a lot of times we're afraid to tell people our limits. But I've found that people appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
They appreciate the honesty, and they appreciate your concern for them that you will be their pastor, mm-hmm. and you will not abandon them, and that you want to give them the best help that you can.
Yeah.
By sending them someplace else.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important, just as a pastoral function, to know where the best help is. It's an incredibly important function of your ministries.
I think when we refer, sometimes we lose the opportunity to bring sacramental healing to people if we don't have a really good relationship with that person we refer them to.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to have that person come back in a confessional attitude, take all of this stuff inside and lay it out there, and to be able to bring the forgiveness of Christ specifically to those things mm-hmm. that are bothering. A hand-in-glove relationship with a counselor, a few times I've had it, has been an absolutely wonderful experience to be able to bring the specifics. I confess this, I am absolved by Christ of this, I commune. And I accept his forgiveness. Been some tremendous things happen in relationships like that.
We have a retainer with a counseling firm where we know the therapists well, and they not only tell us when people have actually completed their work, and they'll consult back with us, but they'll also send them back to us for faith issues, absolution, and so forth. It is helpful.
Yes.
The old maxim of ounce of prevention with a pound of cure. You mentioned the pulpit, the sacraments, individual confession, something that Luther recommended.
Yep.
Most of this day at the moment practice, but there are books out that do speak about the validity of it. If not to cure, at least helps the sensing process of the pastor so he can find where the minefields are.
Yeah. It is also, I think, enormously important for the pastor to be a person who, from the pulpit and from the teaching, from the podium, from individual conversations, assist persons in defining theologically what is taking place with them clinically. Let me run that one through you again. A pastoral function is to assist people in defining spiritually faith language what is taking place with them clinically. A counseling process for a deeply wounded human being is in fact dying and rising again. It is the profound mystery of the faith. And to be able to say what is happening to a person in terms of the language of our faith, and to translate the immediate experiences of their life into the heritage which they've known as faith, is an incredibly important function. It's not a function that's a counseling, because it's going to use the pulpit, it's going to use the altar, it's going to use all kinds of different functions. But realizing the processes involved with persons' lives who are in the midst of healing, just being able to continually tell people to say what it is that is taking place with you, and to offer, you know, the quantity of hope which is so, you know, which is so essential to them. Earhart.
Yes, like I was saying, I think the spot to make a connection would be to, at the time you refer a person, to suggest or at least ask whether they would be willing to provide a release of contact
yes.
with the counselor. Mm-hmm. And that bridge established. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most counselors, the vast majority of them that I've had any contact with, really want that bridge.
Well, you must be very fortunate then, because the ones I have run into, and of course, I'll tell you, it's a small area, but their first idea is when you refer them to counseling, they cut you off immediately from any input or any connection there. And then the counselor comes up from wherever he comes up from, and the first thing he says is, you got to clear your head of all this religious nonsense, and we'll get you back on your mental feet, so to speak. Then they have a couple of advocates in this group, and one of them in particular reads into every woman that comes in there with a problem, the problem she had with her husband, and her counsel is dump the bomb. And I followed this statistically, and that's what she tells everyone that I have run across that would wanted to talk about it. Dump the bomb, because yeah. she had a real bad marriage, and I've talked to her too, and that's her.
Yeah. I think that's an unfortunate experience, and I just try to find somebody.
And
just make a better referral.
Icing on the cake, when they happen to get a court order, a restraining order, or order protection, they send some of these advocates over, and some of them are so boozed up they can't read the paper, and they're supposed to help these people fill out the forms.
Go, one over here.
The one thing that I dislike most about moving is the contacts that I have established of people who I trust in terms of referral.
They're not, these referral lists, I'm not talking about something really simple to come by here. I'm talking about something that's really hard to come by. But it's so crucial. Yes.
I've been counseling with a couple for about maybe 4 hours now, marriage counseling. And they've gotten to the point where the woman has said that, she said, I don't know whether we can get, I'm afraid to get into the areas. We're doing some exploring and so on and so forth. They're doing some exploring in terms of values and expectations of one another and so on and so forth. And she's told me on the way out just this last week that she said, I'm afraid that I don't know whether I can go any farther into it, but I want to. And I told her, I said, well, I says, you may not be able to do that with me. I may have to recommend someone to you to do that with, but you need to do it. And she says, I want to do it with you, but I don't have any more training than any training in marital counseling per se. I'm kind of hung up because they seem to be benefiting on the one hand, but I don't want to go so far that I'm beyond my capabilities. What would you?
Any others? How many of the others handled it? A couple things come to my mind, certainly to try to make a referral. You might try to get her permission
to have a marriage and family counselor co-counsel with you, to bridge a gap, to make a bridge between your involvement with her and her husband and involvement with a person with more expertise. That would be just one thing that has come to my mind that I've done a couple of times, which has been very, very helpful. Because once the trust relationship is established, particularly if it's someone you know well and whose skills you really value, once that trust relationship is established, then she will move on to that other counselor. But ask her if you can have someone there with you, that your skills are limited and that you would like to slowly introduce someone else into the counseling relationship. And do so for a couple of weeks and see if that's a way that you can make the bridge. It is a feeling of unsafety. And I think it's well documented that very often clergy, as ministers of the church, we are the first line, and sometimes the first person ever trusted with this stuff. And that's just stark reality, but I think we have to learn ways to make those bridges into professional care that can help. Will?
Well, just one of the real practical problems I run into is that the system is overloaded.
Oh, yes.
And to get people in, you may be talking 6 weeks to six months before they can even get into the system.
And again, let me just stress supervision for something like that. If you find yourself in a prolonged relationship with a counseling relationship, make sure you have somebody with whom you're backed up.
In response to that, though, if you have a good relationship and a good rapport with one of these counselors, a lot of times they will make the time and get those people in. But you have to establish some contacts. So.
Mm-hmm. The best thing is go out and convert them. Bring them into your church.
I think I have something to help with that, though. I'm fortunate they have a wife working in the system. And I think if you know someone who is working within the system, you can kind of avoid some of the things that you were talking about, because you can find those who have the kind of integrity that you're looking for and use those as your referral people. Mm-hmm.
Let me move back. Another just kind of, and this is just a shopping list is what I'm doing this morning. But let me just I don't want to discourage conversations, but I do have a few things I want to get. I guess I'm point five. Be aware that our culture, and I really think it is especially our culture tends to eroticize intimacy relationships. I'll say more about that in another context later. Very often, pastors find themselves in closeness relationships with persons which, if it's that person might be eroticizing or the pastor might be eroticizing, and be aware of that tendency which is cultural. For instance, I believe that much of what we read in the literature of understanding human loneliness today, or pardon me, of human sexuality, is in fact human loneliness. People who feel lonely, quite often in our culture, are led to believe that they need a good sex life. Loneliness is very different from sex life. Sometimes, in fact, sexual activity, pardon me, the loneliest people you will find are in a singles bar. And they are desperately looking for human intimacy and friendship. And sexuality becomes the cultural way that they think that should be accomplished. Because there's all kinds of images, particularly of maleness, that are translated erotically, but represent far more intense needs. Our culture eroticizes relatedness, and it is everywhere. And it is something that I think needs, we have to be conscious of in terms of our own sexuality, because we do it too. And I have some real sense of urgency that we know the difference between our own sexuality and its needs and the other needs of our life, and be able to make the distinctions and clarify our roles. Know what to do with your loneliness. Know what to do with your need for spiritual life. I'll say more. Know what to do about your needs for self-care. Know what to do about your own dynamics. And in counseling relationships, which are, if helpful, are intimate, in those relationships of counseling, be as professionally defined as a pastor as possible. In other words, a very specific sense of location, of time. Don't go on the midnight calls to lonely people. That is dumb. A very presence in terms of just gesture and postures, the use of furniture, all these little symbolic things. Watch out for what is taking place with you in these counseling relationships. Monitor the tendency within you to eroticize relationships, because we all have that tendency. It is part of what I would call systemic sexual violence. It is all a massive lie. But an awareness of what is taking place and what we, that we are inheritors of the cultural issues, as well as the persons with whom we are counseling. That moves me. Are you raising hands? That moves me into another area, and I'm going to give credit here to some work done by Pete Steinke. Actually, it's some notes that you gave me, Earhart, a couple of years ago, and I've used them over and over again. Peter Steinke is the, actually, he's kind of the counterpart of Consultation to Clergy in Texas. It's the only other program I know of that exists quite the same definition. He works for Lutheran Social Services. He's an LCMS pastor, counselor. He's got some interesting books out, by the way, a couple of his new books on congregations and pastoral wellness kind of things. But he has worked with 100 pastors who have had extramarital affairs. And he has come to define a personality which, in all due candor, relates to an awful lot of us. And he talks about it as a high vulnerability personality. So I would like to just sort of get into his work very briefly and just talk about something of what he sees as the issues of a pastor's sexuality that may lead us to need to monitor. Be aware of what's taking place with us, especially. He suggests that an unusually large number of pastors have come from family of origins in which a particular profile is very consistent. Let me also suggest to you that this particular family profile is also what makes us good pastors. Again, the point of our vulnerability is the point of our strength. If you know it and understand it. The profile he describes is this. A family of origin, that pastors with problems with their own sexuality, their problems usually begin at birth. And that their family of origins are something like this. They're persons whose fathers have been emotionally distant. that the father-son relationship particularly is a relationship in which the father was not highly nurturant, loving, gentle, caring person. Their fathers, in fact, were sometimes stern and or abusive and violent. I must confess that in counseling practices inside and outside of the clergy profession, I would say I hear of males who are victims of childhood violence infinitely more often inside the clergy profession than I ever did out. Fathers who are emotionally distant and who do not quite give approval of their son's life. James Nelson suggests in his book Intimate Connection, Male Sexuality and Masculine Spirituality, that it may be one of the reasons why we Lutherans have to always say that we are totally justified and acceptable by God our Father, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, is that we never quite got enough of it. Interesting comment. That they come from homes where the father was emotionally distant and not quite accepting, and homes in which the mother also was a person of high expectations on her son and a high expectation of behavior. What you create in the son is what I had on the board. Picture a board, picture the word here. Dualism. You have a constitutional dualism from the minute you're born. These are persons who bear this kind of wound and need closeness. They move into the ministry and have an incredible sense of an intuitive sense of the wounded. They frequently have passive aggressive behavior because they don't like displeasing people. They love to be accepted. They warmly bask in the compliments and in the love. In fact, they're dependent upon the compliments and the love. All the affirming strokes we get as pastors are extremely important. They have a very difficult time expressing negative emotions because negative emotions like anger and sexuality are emotions which the dualism of their childhood has learned cannot be reconciled. They do not, in fact, have sexual affairs, they have emotional affairs. The sexual element of their relationship is secondary to a highly dependent need for intimacy and nurture and acceptance. They live on the edge of a kind of a narcissistic, passive, aggressive behavior most of the time. And they always come off as incredibly nice guys. The biggest problem they face with their sexuality is not guilt, which the law would speak, and the gospel, the biggest problem is shame. Now, that personality type, and I don't want to, you know, classify it as somehow or other indelibly wounded and deeply kind of all the rest. That personality type is also incredibly tuned
to the needs of human beings, incredibly tuned to lives of compassionate service and care. But it has to be aware of what is taking place. It has to be aware that there are needs which must be met in healthy, whole ways. It must be aware of needing to break through the fundamental conflicts of one's own life. Any thoughts? Any questions? That was the answer to the question that you asked. I'm going to do it probably a little more. Yes?
I'm just having a little trouble with narcissistic passive-aggressive. Can you give an example
narcissistic
of that?
Person is, well, Narcissus is the Greek myth of the person who sees, who sees themselves in the myth or in the pool, in the pool's reflection. A narcissistic person is a person who, when I talk to you, I see you, but what I'm really focusing on at the same time is myself. I'm seeing myself through your eyes. As a matter of fact, I have a hard time defining myself until I see myself through your eyes. I have a hard time telling you who I am unless I see myself reflected as a good person in and through the eyes of another person who sees me as good. So it is necessary for my identity and my own sense of value that I cultivate relationships with persons in such a way that they define me. Okay? Going back to where we were in terms of the characteristics of victims of abuse. Because we're defining here an abusive situation. Childhood. Victims of abuse tend to have great difficulty with self-value and self-image. In the narcissistic personality, and I'm just picking one characteristic of the narcissistic personality, finds self-value and self-image as it is reflected through the eyes of another. And it is very difficult to separate one's own needs and one's own self from the other. It's hard to focus on others except as they reflect. It's not like some people call it sort of a selfishness or made it equated with selfishness. Not selfishness at all. It has to do with a dynamic going on within me that I need.
Would it be wise for me to listen to Leon Vergantry?
Yes.
The only thing Sinclair Lewis didn't do was delve into the reasons why Elmer was the way he was. He merely portrayed it.
Yeah.
But what you said, could you apply that to Elmer Gantry?
Yeah. It's been a while since I read Elmer Gantry, but I think, you know, Elmer Gantry is a pretty classic case of a person. I would prefer to use the language of the historic heresy of the church dualism. It's a person whose outward side he continually tries to reflect as nice, good, positive, affirming, because he's always trying somehow or other to deal with the inner side, which remains kind of hidden and covert.
The only thing you've not done so far for me is describe a couple of moles I have over here. But make that comment because I give thanks to the Lord and wish I had as much insight of myself as a person, let's say 10, 15, 20 years ago, as I have now. And I think that's an extremely valuable journey.
You've had a lot. And you see, I am not talking about a pathology here. I am talking about a characteristic of human life that makes us very good pastors. You know, okay? I want to affirm that. But it's one that can lead to problems, particularly in terms of ourselves and the energies of human sexuality and identity.
No. What you're showing us is what Paul said. He always monitors himself lest he falls.
You bet.
Knowing that he's as bad as I am, chief of sinners, my bishop.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But he also knew he was a nice guy.
Would professionalism be a part of that?
Sure. The other question with passive aggressive behavior is, it's when I really want to be aggressive. I really want to be, you know, but I can't. And so I have to be nice. I mean, I have to come off to you as nice. And so the way I come off to you as nice is that I walk up to you and I shake your hand like a nice guy in the back, or do aggression, or kick your shin, or somehow or other, there's a covert act which is aggressive that is hidden, but the overt act is passive in general.
The description of a passive aggressive is a dog licking your hands and peeing on your foot.
Pastors in Yakima have been studying that Myers-Briggs book. Title, Jack, is what, Rick?
Religious types and leadership styles.
Extremely good section on sexuality there and understanding that those dynamics. And I highly recommend it. It comes out of Alban Institute.
I don't know that. I've seen that.
Excellent book on that.
What is it?
Title again, Rick, is what?
Religious types and leadership styles. It's out of Alban Institute. Yeah.
It's Kroger and Oswald.
Yeah.
Roy Oswald's work.
But it does note that, you know, the certain personality types have a lot higher incident. And as we sat around the table discussing this, the fellows that had that personality type, every one talked about being in compromising situations where it could have gone either way. Mm-hmm. And some of us with other personality types are sitting there and, you know, and, gee, I must really be ugly or something, you know, because I don't get those situations. Does that have something to do with curly logs?
I want to check out one thing with you to see if I hear you correctly. What I hear you saying is that we need to be very conscious about how we posture ourselves in relation to those who have come seeking our care.
Yes.
I don't think you're saying, but sometimes it feels to me like you're saying, repress your own sexuality.
Oh no, I'm not saying that.
Make sure that you put yourself in a position where that doesn't ever arise and where you don't ever have neurotic feelings and your own sensuality doesn't rise to the surface. You're not saying that.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I am saying that good counseling does have strong notes of intimacy which can be, and in fact, have strong notes of sexuality. To be able to affirm that, to claim that, is extremely important. As a matter of fact, I think we fall into a diabolically dualistic trap if we don't. I'm just simply saying, know what it is, be able to name the dynamics going on within oneself, so that when one is aware of the sexual dynamics taking place in a constant relationship, one is also aware of the importance of molding an appropriate and valued sense of sexuality.
Eldon, Pastor Hawk, and I think Earhart back there have been trying to get your attention.
Pastor Hawk.
I'm trying to arrange my thought processes and get them checked out to see where I am, the need for correction and the need for justice. And I'm also thinking in terms of our chief, let's call it the weapon, if you understand what I mean, the name of the gospel, to fix what's wrong. And I'm also having in mind more of what we can do to prevent the need for, or to make the need for counseling unnecessary, and be in a helpful, sphere whereby the dramatic expression of these problems is not seen.
Now, I have a picture in my mind of that chalkboard with the two lines and the division, the dualism. And on the right side is what I can perceive to be the expression of what's wrong on the other side. On the left side of that line is a low self-esteem, guilt. And you add up rottenness and other things, so, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that finds expression, negative or whatever way you want to say, on the right side of the stuff that becomes visible. I'm perceiving, and I need to check this out, that which the person needs to fix what's going on inside is an act of God whereby he sees himself as not rotten, as not guilty, as having a high value. And to take the flip side of those things you have listed there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we say that God is the one who can fix it, and I would subscribe to that, I see a couple of directions. I think God uses psychology and counselors. I think he functions through them, which is not, however, typically and always it's a theologically or spiritual in its nature. It need not always be spiritual in its nature. Now, I see also a spiritual dimension. And there I would see the gospel as the rock, not the law, but the gospel. Now, in the gospel, that's embodied in Jesus Christ. Okay, but I see two problems there. One is the cross, the suffering and dying. But the other problem, which I think is a great need, and this is what I want to check out, and that is what we term justification, which I would write in simple terms, not guilty. The cross speaks to the malady of fear of punishment. The justification, the not guilty, based on the life of Jesus, speaks to the malady of guilt. Predominantly, but not completely, the cross helps me with contemplating my future and my future destiny and my fear of dying. Predominantly, the other side, Jesus' life and not guilty, helps me with the now. Now, I have been contending for 20 years, most of them silent contentions, not public, that we do a good job with the cross, and that we do very badly with the not guilty side. Teaching the value of Jesus' life, which is also the gospel. I have a little thing which some of the brethren know about. In the catechism, we are taught that justification by grace for Christ's own faith is the chief doctrine of the Christian religion. And if you take that in its narrow sense, that really means, if you say justification and you really, you know, take the meaning that we get out of the confessions and the catechism and so forth, it's God declaring the sinner not guilty. Now hold on to that now. I contend that we hear that so very, very, very little. And God's way of saying it to us is through the scriptures, of course. He intends for us to carry it around among people where it does some good. He intends to do that to people. And I don't want you to answer this, but what did you ask you it said to you?
What was the question? What was the...
The question is, when did somebody last say to you, I'm not guilty, you're okay. I take it just the way you are. I love you in orange. Okay? Now, if I read and hear sermons, and I listen to a few of them, you know, and I read stuff, education stuff, I see the cross, that big of the gospel comment. But the other side, I don't see. Now, my real question then is it a proper conception of gospel teaching and proclamation to use that leg to fix what's wrong? And we had that word guilty up there. I'm not thinking so much of counseling those that are in jams, of course it's usable there too, but I'm thinking of the whole pattern of teaching and proclamation and ministry. Is that a a reasonably proper conception of how to work successfully or how to work as less wrong expected results. No, I'm not sure that I do well to load that whole thing on you.
Well,
my own perception of my own perhaps way of putting it would be that in the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, we have the prolegomena to all Christian reflection. It is the doctrinal formulation which informs everything else, and according to which everything that goes on here, everywhere, me, is ultimately conditioned. That in the doctrine of justification, I have a statement, not guilty,
well, of course,
but that I don't have to worry about being innocent.
That's great. Okay.
I don't have to worry about being right. I don't have to be worrying about being perfect. I don't have to be worrying about showing a face of myself. I can care less about being right. Now, I have a hard time gut level appropriating that message. That is an incredibly profound psychological clinical process and enormously important. And I would say the doctrine of justification, as it applies to, particularly to an understanding not only of Christian anthropology from the standpoint of original sin, but also Christian anthropology from the standpoint of baptism, that my life is now defined in terms of the continuous dynamic.
Could it also be, besides being a psychologically profound, complicated process, could it be also a miracle which God works in us through the gospel?
Oh.
Now we're at the point that I want to be at.
Well, in other words, I'm
trying to recognize that there's a, I'm sure there's this pure, there's no overlapping, but there's a psychological arm of helping, and there's also a specifically, which is not unpsychological, but a specifically spiritual arm.
Yep.
And God uses them both.
But I think he put them in two different arms, but that's okay.
Well, he does have two.
I want to move on because we've only got about 8 minutes here. There's some other questions. Yeah, Jack?
Two out of three legs.
Earhart,
quick question. What do you do when a counselee starts making sexual overtures? How do you refuse them and at the same time affirm the person? How do you make referrals, or what do you do?
Well,
I don't refer to the overture.
Refer to the overture.
That's a good question. Enormously. Particularly if they're symbolic or suggestive. I think one of the things you do if a counselee makes sexual overtures is you enjoy them and laugh at them. Don't take them so awfully serious that you get involved in that person's swamp. Does that make sense?
That's a good comment.
You can take that very, very serious. A, you can say, thank you very much. Giggle, giggle. I'm pleased you find me attractive, and then go right on. Now, if the person is obviously obsessed at that point, you have to deal through the whole thing about transference and all that that means and how we engage and disengage and all the rest of the language. You can get into those things in terms of codependency issues and stuff like that. But I guess my initial reaction to it is humor and enjoyment. It's rather nice if somebody finds us sexually attractive. Thank you very much. Giggle, giggle. And it goes back to what Scott's saying. Do we shelve our sexuality? No, we don't shelve our sexuality. We simply understand it within the context of this.
What if your face gets all red in the prostitute?
Well,
There aren't any questions.
I didn't have a question, but I'm just going to add, is it appropriate to, since I referred to also that I'm happily married?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So that you indicate, you know, you're taking care of
somebody says, you know, it gives an intimation of sexual attractiveness, you just say, yes, my wife will enjoy your marriage. I wouldn't make it a tremendously heavy issue because you might be providing some kind of a barrier for the person, you know, all kinds of guilt and stuff. It may well be a very healthy part of that person's process of claiming their own sexualities. In which case, you want to affirm it and say, thank you very much.
I've had experience with that.
Oh.
Being by a gay man who came in and my office and told me that. And it works. I mean, it works. I say, well, thank you very much for the flattery, but, you know, we just joked about it, and it worked. Yeah. Yeah. It didn't cause any other problems.
Yes.
The final, the best result to do what Joseph did. Run out of the house and say, how can I sin against
my family? Make it.
Make it. Let me just
summarize some things about pastoral self-care in terms of sexuality issues. As I suggested to you at the beginning, much of what takes place, which we interpret as genital sexuality issues, is in fact much more comprehensive, much deeper in ourselves. We really have to do self-care. And I just sort of looked at that in terms of three dimensions here, if I may. I think the biggest problem we face in terms of the biggest problem I hear about in terms of the daily exercise of the pastor's ministry is loneliness. When I did my little survey here 3 years ago and said, what's the main problem you face in the pastoral office, 76% of all pastors sent back and said, the biggest problem I have is loneliness. Listen to that one. Listen real carefully to that one. It is real easy to eroticize loneliness because our culture does it all the time. Know the meaning of friendship. The vast majority of Christian history, all those medieval monks and all the rest of the traditions of our heritage, did not deal with the primary issue of sexual relationships. The primary ethical issue was friendship, amikitia. The meaning of friendship is an infinitely more valued study of Christian ethics than is the meaning of sexuality. It is an incredibly important and desperately neglected aspect of the pastor's life. We live too much as prima donnas and lonely persons. A lot of it is imposed by the office, I agree. We know too much. There are a lot of things we cannot share. We do not share. We must not share. But I love the New Testament word koinonia. I like it because of, not because of its implications in rooms like this, which are gathered for sacred purposes, which in some ways violate the word. I like it because the Greek word means common life. Common, common, common. Find relationships which are common. And I mean common, dirt common. Find relationships in which it is permissible to sweat and swear. And those kinds of the relationships, I think, are desperately needed for all of us. Break through some kind of way by which we ourselves are placed into the dualistic trap. And do that through establishment of koinonia, establishment of a sense of commonness of life. Some place where you can get mad. I mean, really mad.
And if you want to call somebody something affectionate, call them that loudly in the confidence that it is not going to be heard by the world. Some sort of a place where we blast off, some sort of place where we go to ball games, some sort of place where we have Gemütlichkeit or whatever you call it. I never thought that was ice cream, by the way.
Of course, cheese. Whatever works.
And associated with an entirely different ritual.
But anyway, some place where you establish friendship. I don't care whether it's a group of peer pastoral support systems. Most pastors, however, say who are dealing with significant problems in their lives that one of the last people they would go to for a deep friendship is a fellow pastor. I think that's unfortunate. Says something. But at any rate, some kind of a place, a person, a relationship, not just one's spouse.
Amen.
That is way too much heavy for a spouse to carry. All of our relational needs. And I don't know what kind of form and formula it does. I know I'm always an enormously healthier human being by the middle of November because there's four of us that we call the Old Farts Club that gets together every November. For 22 years we've done it. We've spent 1 week together. And we do nothing but complain. So my mid-November, I'm always an infinitely more mellow person. My wife, the first year I went, thought it was an unnecessary waste of time. Every year since then, she's been packing my bags 3 or 4 weeks ahead of time. I don't know what it's going to be for you. I have no idea what it is. But we don't do that. We just do not do that as systemic self-care. And we can babble on and on and on about it. But I cannot stress that enough as a way of dealing with fundamental needs for understanding ourselves as sexual human beings, because it is in relationships of friendships which we do not do violence, we do not do abuse. And this is particularly marked for men. It is a men's problem. Biggest characteristic, we've been doing this thing about mentors with consultation with the clergy and the ELCA's women pastors versus the male pastors. We sent out the letter 6 months, 8 months after a person has arrived. We say we'd like to establish with you some kind of a mentoring relationship, and we'd like you to, the men always write back and say, well, gee, I don't know whether I need one really, I'll kind of get back to you, or yeah, that'd be all right, I guess. I write to the women pastors, and women pastors, thank you very much, I already got one. It's the biggest characteristic I've noted, the difference between men pastors and women pastors. It is a male problem. Secondly, some way of somatizing our life. A way of taking care of our own bodies. We spend the vast majority of our energies and our time, intellectual and emotional energy. We rarely translate it into our bodies, just plain old hunk of flesh. I don't know what it's going to be for you, whether it's some exercise program, whether it's some way of dealing with some sense of yourself. Participated in workshops where you do creative dance or you lay on the floor and feel the earth or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. So that was fun, actually. But some kind of a sense of stopping the constant dualistic process which our employment necessitates. Our employment calls upon us to be thinking, feeling people. It does not call on us to value our own human bodies.
I've got a 110-pound lad, and I go bird hunting religiously every hunting season.
Okay. A physical exercise, some way of routinizing this, some way of dealing with this. Particularly a way of getting expression for sexuality and anger. Some way of, of,
of coming, how do you say it, claiming our own bodies. And finally, let me just talk just very briefly. The issue of a pastor as a sexual person, I think, is an intensely spiritual issue. It is ultimately a spiritual issue because it results, its travesties result from the fundamental heresy of the church, the fundamental dualism which we've been fighting for centuries. It has to do with the faith understanding and the spiritual understanding, not just a theological understanding. It has to do with the spiritual understanding of self. So a spiritual life which talks about the whole me, which speaks to the whole me, and which speaks to the whole me in terms of the transformative possibilities of the hope of the gospel. Some kind of spiritual life in which I see myself and know myself, pray for self in a holistic sense. And it's not just a matter of reading next Sunday's text and wondering how we might preach it. It's a matter of an engagement with the Word. It's a matter of an engagement in the thoughts and prayers for others and ourselves that has to do with an intensification, maybe even an acting out in ways which are physical, that we really intensify ourselves and come to grips with ourselves as whole persons. I'm going to stop there because I'm over time. Thoughts, questions, comments, I'll just walk it off. Thoughts, reflections.
Just one comment. You had said earlier that the biggest problem was not with guilt, but with shame. Is that somewhat uniquely Lutheran with our emphasis on grace or not?
No, I don't think so.
Or how are you defining shame then?
I think the shame is the feeling that someone, others will not find us acceptable. The feeling that we're going to be somehow really
that I'm not all right.
That I'm not all right. So shame means that we live in a constant state of fear. Guilt means that we desperately want forgiveness, so we want some assurance. But guilt, you see, is you hear the gospel, you can do something about guilt. Shame is tough because you can't do anything. No. Except power.
If I have done a sin in my past and I say, oh yeah, I know I did that, but God forgives me, it seems to me that is not forgiveness, that's denial. That's not forgiving myself, that's denial.
Pick
it up later.
Any thoughts? I'm conscious of your pressures of time, and I don't want to dishonor any questions or comments, but thank you very much. Good to be with you.